Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Food, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Amir Sayed Abdi, the host of the channel. Today, I have the pleasure to talk to Rosa Abreu-Bronkel about her new book, Vanilla, A Global History, which was published in 2020 by Reaction Books. Rosa is an assistant professor at New York City College of Technology, the Hospitality Department. Rosa, thanks for accepting my invitation. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me to your podcast.
Okay, to start off, Rosa, I'd like to ask you to give us a bit of background about yourself and also about your research.
Well, I basically started off in hospitality management. I worked in hotels for many years in the arena of food and beverage. And then I transitioned into teaching hospitality management. I always have had an interest in food. And this is what led me to start thinking about my scholarship and what I wanted to do. And that led me to Vanilla.
The book is published as part of Reaction Books' Edible series. And for those listeners who don't know about Edible series, it's a series that focuses on the global history and culture of one type of food or beverage in each of its book. And your book, Rosa, is on vanilla. Why vanilla?
Well, it's funny how that intertwined with my childhood. Like I mentioned, I was looking for a topic for my scholarship, and I picked up a Wall Street Journal, which is one of our papers here in the States. And I read that there was a shortage of vanilla in the coming from Madagascar due to global warming. So that just basically just came to me as you know this topic, and immediately transported me to vanilla in my childhood. I come from the Dominican Republic, and our vanilla, it is extremely potent. You put a little bit and you smell it. And I remember as a child, my mother cooking all these wonderful desserts with vanilla. And that became the topic that I wanted to write about.
Okay, it's really interesting how our childhood, you know, adventures and memories take us through a whole career. Could you give us a light version sort of the historical background of vanilla as you discuss in your book? I mean, where does it come from? How long has it been in existence? And how long has it been used as an ingredient? And also, has it been used differently in different cultures throughout history?
Well, just to start off with the historical perspective of vanilla, has been in existence for more than 70 million years. And the vine in its natural state has grown from North America, we're talking about Mexico, to all the way to South America in the northern part of Brazil. Now, what we know of the human usage of vanilla has been in humans using it about 2,000 to 3,000 years. How that we came about this shriveled up pod, it is thought that the indigenous people saw the vanilla pod shriveled up on the forest floor, and they picked it up and they started using it. And they used it as a remedy. They used, they mixed it with pine resin, and in that pine resin became, they used to put it as incense in their temples. So the Mesoamerican cultures of the time were that used vanilla, and it's not well known. It was the, you know, the Olmecs, the Toltecs, the Mayans, the Totonecs, and the final users were the Aztecs. And the Totonecs were basically considered, they're considered still to this day, the guardians of vanilla. How this came about was because they have certain stories connected to the vine. And one of them is, one of these stories is Sacna, who was the daughter of the goddess of fertility. And she fell in love with a mortal man. She knew she couldn't be human. So she decided to convert herself into a vanilla vine. So for the Totonecs, this was a sign of devotion and love. And they decided to adapt the actual vine itself through these stories, right? This one of them, but there's a lot more that have become part of the folklore. Incoming Columbus, and obviously with Columbus right behind him comes the conquistadors. And the conquistadors obviously came with you know, with the church and priest into that in that part of the world. And Hernan Cortez is the basically the person that comes in and says, well, we're gonna make this. He didn't have a lot of men, but however, he made an impression on the indigenous population who hated the Mayans, they actually hated the Aztecs. Why? Because the Aztecs were cruel to their human subjects. They did human sacrifices. So when these other indigenous groups saw the Spaniards or the conquistadors coming along towards Mexico City, they join in and they helped obviously conquer Mexico. Now, when the conquistadors came to Mexico City and Montezuma and his people saw them, they thought they were gods. They'd never seen weapons. They'd never seen a horse. So they treated them with banquets and all types of delicacy that they ate at those times. So one of the things that one of the soldiers from Hernan Cortez's crew was Bernard Diaz de Castillo. And he noticed that Montezuma was drinking this brew. He was drinking all these cups of this particular brew, and he was curious. So they tried it, and the Aztecs call it Xocotl, which is what we know today as chocolate. And the brew was thick, was bitter. The Spaniards thought it was disgusting. But it had obviously chocolate, it had vanilla, it had honey and other spices, which for Montezuma, it was considered to be an aphrodisiac since he had a harem full of wives at the time. Now, the secret to vanilla and how it was produced was never really divulged by the Totonecs. They actually gathered the actual pods in the wild, but never told anyone about where they were producing or what to do with them. So until there was a friar that came from Spain, his name was Fernandino de Sahagún, and he started living with the indigenous people and watching to see what they were doing. And one of the things that he noticed was that they were using vanilla and mixing it up with other herbs and chilies for urine flow, for obviously aphrodisiac, for stomach problems, for flatulence. So he recorded all of this. Now, all of this information was published 250 years later after his death, and it became the Florentine Codex. And the Florentine Codex was actually kept in the Vatican until John Paul became the Pope. He basically decided to return the codex back to the Mexican people. So it's now in the National Archives of Mexico with all, obviously, with all of the information that he gathered. So what is really vanilla? Vanilla belongs to the largest family of flowering plants in the world. The bean belongs to angiosperms that belongs to the plantae kingdom. And the plantae kingdom has, you know, obviously the peas, the soybeans, lentils, acacia, alfalfa. Those are the ones that come from this particular kingdom. And this is where vanilla comes from. We have 110 varieties of vanilla and 25,000 hybrids that have been identified. Now, the main vanilla variety, it is called Panifolia. And Panifolia is considered to be the mother of commercial vanillas and is actually cultivated in Mexico and Madagascar. You have also Pampona, and Pampona is actually used for perfumes. You have Tajentesis, which is a cross between Panifolia and Adorata, which was bred. This particular variety was brought to the French Polynesia, and now that's why it's called this particular name. Now, you also have other varieties, Indora, Mexicana, Hardy, and Bicolor. And obviously many more. Vanilla itself, how is produced? It's actually produced if it's in the wild, obviously it's a climber. And it climbs many trees up to, you know, the canopy. And the natural pollinators of the actual flower is Melipona, hummingbirds, but mainly it will be the euglena bee, which is a real, real tiny bee that actually gets inside the flower. And what happens with it, so the flower has both sexes. So once the bee goes inside, the sticky pollen gets into the body. And as they're exiting the flower, it actually pollinates it. And this is how, you know, the bean is produced. Now, many horticulturists were intrigued. Also, the English and the French wanted to break the monopoly, the 200-year monopoly that Mexico had with vanilla. And what they did was they looked into the empires and they said, well, we have countries that have the same climate. So there's two ways of producing the actual vine, cuttings or the tiny little seeds. Obviously, the cuttings will be more successful. And what they did was they took the cuttings to, the French took the cuttings to Bourbon Island, which is now called Reunion Island. And in Reunion Island and other, you know, Madagascar, Reunion, other places, the vines did thrive. However, they did not produce any beans, or sometimes they didn't flower, or sometimes they did flower. So they were quite intrigued with this. And obviously the beans, they were known in Europe, and they were really, really concerned about how we're gonna produce this. So Hugh Morgan, which is the apothecary to Queen Elizabeth at the time, he gave some beans to one of the horticulturists and scientists to kind of study. Queen Elizabeth I, loved sweets, and he basically started putting vanilla in all of her food. And because, again, it had this idea that it was, it was an aphrodisiac. So that's in Europe. This is where vanilla is going. You had Louis the 14th, his lover, Marquise de Montespan, used to bathe in vanilla beans and flowers. Also, Marie Antoinette, she wanted to have a perfume made. It had a perfume made with vanilla and flowers as well. So obviously vanilla is slowly growing in popularity. You had it in Paris and it was exhibited a flower, but it died. And then you had, you actually had a botanist who in Brussels, who really studied the vine. And he basically came with the conclusion that the flower needed to be pollinated. 2 years later, after this discovery, which was not published, in the island of Reunion, in one of the plantations, Mr. Beaumont, who was a botanist himself, he had a 12-year-old slave boy. His name was Alvius. And he used to make rounds around the plantation. And one day he had an actual 22-year-old vine of vanilla, and which flowered but never producing fruit. One day that he was walking around, all of a sudden he sees fruit. And he was amazed. I was like, how does this happen? And he asked Alvius, did you do something to it? Alvius was like, well, this is what I did. I took a bamboo stick and I inserted into the flower. And this is, I guess, what happened. So they couldn't believe it. They couldn't believe it. All these plantation owners, they were botanists, they were scientists. They couldn't figure out how this fruit was going to come out. And a slave boy who was 12 years old figured it out. So he did it again. He showed everybody and it produced the beans. So obviously he was freed after this. He died in poverty. But he basically left a legacy of millions and millions of dollars. Now, vanilla mass produced is still done to this day. Vanilla is actually pollinated by hand, by women, by children, by men. This is how it's done, the actual bees. So fast forward, America. So Thomas Jefferson, who became the diplomat representing the United States in Europe, went to Paris. And when he went to Paris, he bought his slave called James Hemans. And James Hemans was his cook. And an actual fact, which is an interesting fact, is that James Hemans becomes the first American to be actually taught how to cook in the French culinary arts. So he's a slave, and he's actually the first American to be taught on how to cook French food. So Jefferson comes back to the United States, but he continues to ask Paris, you know, his contact in Paris, to bring him back the vanilla beans because he couldn't get it in the States. And so Jefferson started, there's a famous ice cream, which is in the book, ice cream recipe, which is the vanilla recipe. And to me, it was like, okay, Jefferson, it's Jefferson ice cream, but I believe James Hemans was really the one behind this recipe because actually he was the chef. So so a little interesting fact in there about it. So again, another great one of the first ladies, Dolly Madison, she did a lot of state dinners at the White House and she served ice cream. Again, giving a more popularity to the flavor itself. So in 1847, Joseph Burnett, who was an American scientist or chemist, he made the first extract. So he was the one that developed the extra vanilla extract that is being able to obviously sold and go into households. In 1818, The vanilla, which is actually the dominant flavor, the flavor and the smell that vanilla has, is called vanillin. And the vanillin is, you know, these, they're tiny little crystals that are outside and inside of the pod that you cannot really see. So Nicholas Gobley was the one that was able to isolate this particular flavor of vanillin. In 1874, there were some German scientists that developed the synthetic flavor of vanilla out of pine bark. So here slowly, obviously, now the chemists and scientists are beginning to get away from the real stuff, and they go into the synthetic portion of vanilla. Now, a pharmacist called Pemberton, he was wounded in the Civil War. And Pemberton was addicted to morphine because of the pains that he was having. So Pemberton decided to concoct something together, which was is called the French syrup. And this French cola syrup had coca leaves, it had vanilla, and it had other oils and other items to make it this cola that he called cola. So this particular syrup, he bought it to a friend pharmacist of his. Now, back in those days, to get syrup, obviously it was the pharmacy. And then soda water was discovered. So in the pharmacies back in those days, it was syrup and soda water that became, you know, the soda that we know today. So little by little, then it became, soda fountains became popular, and it moved away from the pharmacies. Now, World War II came along, and shipping around the world was disrupted, right? You couldn't get vanilla because it was dangerous, ships to be coming in and out of the Indian Ocean or across the world. So it was very dangerous. Now, in World War II, one of the interesting things that the Navy did for their soldiers to bring their morale was they created a floating ice cream ships that were floating from one area to another with vanilla ice cream. They at one point they had about 2,000 gallons of ice cream that they were distributing to the Navy in order to bring morale. Now, also with the war, a popular item that is made, it's the Hostess company, what we call Twinkies. And Twinkies now is made out of vanilla, but back in those days, it was made of bananas. And since there was going to be this disruption of supply of vanilla, Twinkies decided to replace it with the much bland, the executives at the time considered to be the bland flavor of vanilla. So they did that, and it became a hit. So Twinkies still to this day is made out of vanilla. So after the war, marketing firms saw the opportunity of this culture change that was happening. Men came back from the war, and women went back to be homemakers. And basically, the way the companies was able to market their products was giving recipes to homemakers of what to do at home, what to do, you know, with puddings and cakes. And obviously, vanilla comes into play in these recipes. So, how we see vanilla today? Vanilla is considered Madagascar is considered one of the top countries to produce vanilla, as well as Indonesia, China, Mexico, and the largest importers of vanilla is the US, France, and Germany, and other countries. So one of the things within the book that I included while I was doing research was vanilla's pop culture. And vanilla pop culture came about was when I was really looking at the what is called vanilla pop. So I actually looked into this research of vanilla pop, and it came out to be that there is this underlying culture that we have adapted vanilla in within the language that we never realized. So when we talk to someone of you're so vanilla, that means that you're so plain, you're boring, you're bland. When we're talking about your chocolate and I'm vanilla, it's about, you know, again, this whole idea of race. When we look at in terms of the music, right? The music itself, the music is non-threatening. Is basically a genre that is soft, right? The music of ABBA, you know, Olivia Newton-John, and the Carpenters. So sweet, syrupy music that is considered to be vanilla pop. Now, it's vanilla is so ingrained, we don't realize that this particular flavoring was revered by gods. It's in our medicine, it's in soap, it's in beauty products. It is in perfumes, it is in laundry detergent, and we really have no appreciation for it. So when I look at vanilla, and you know, the question comes along of the pop culture, you know, in terms of movies, in terms of music, it also comes about with food, right? So food, it's part of that. And it's not only the sweet, you know, the sweet desserts, right? We talk about savories as well. Since vanilla itself has a chemical compound of about 200 to 500 different types. So in order to be part of the savory, you need to understand what are the chemical compounds of it is. So I got to give it to the French, who actually were the ones that popularized vanilla in desserts, right? The Spaniards brought it to the New World, but they actually put it in their chocolate, but the French really picked it up. And they're the ones who put it in all of the beautiful desserts that we enjoy today. Now, how does vanilla come into play in these different savory sweet taste or foods? Well, if we look at the Mexican vanilla, it's spicy, it's woodsy, so it goes well with chocolate, it goes well with chai tea. The vanilla that comes from Madagascar, which is, by the way, Madagascar and Mexico is Panifolia. So that's basically the same vanilla variety. And so from Madagascar, it's more woodsy and more sweet. So you use it in cakes and ice cream and pastries, seafood, soups and sauces. The Tahitian one is more used for pastry creams, for pies, for smoothies, for puddings, for custards, salad dressings, sweet potatoes, and cocktails. So each variety has its own profile that you're able to use it in these different foods, and it's going to complement. I remember reading a review that someone said, she has like weird food with vanilla. But if you think about it, if it's used in ice cream, it goes well with cream, it goes well with butter, it goes well with eggs. So it complements it. And I'm talking about the actual bean itself that you scrape off, and that is called a caviar, right? The caviar that you scrape off and then you put it into the salad dressing. So you put it into scrambled eggs. So This is why when I was looking and researching the flavor profile of the actual bean itself, I found it to be so interesting. And the pollination that still goes on today, it has to be hand cut. There is a lot of crime attached to it because there's robbers, there's corruption, there's a lot of things attached to the actual production of it. And obviously the prices of the bean itself is higher than ever. One, because obviously of global warming. Two is because we have a much more educated consumer who wants more natural flavors, who are demanding for manufacturers to have more natural products, to have more natural flavorings in their products. So there's a much more demand for it. And I got to give it to McCormick, who actually pushed for regulation of vanilla itself. They wanted regulations to make sure that the beans and the actual production of it was consistent. Not obviously in the factory, out in the field with the farmers is a whole different story. The farmers make really no money out of it, but they make a living of it. And, you know, we have what we call vanilla murders because farmers end up getting involved someone may rob their beans and that's their livelihood. So some of them end up getting killed because of it. So how I came up to with these particular recipes in the book. Like I earlier mentioned, the recipes some of the recipes are more from my childhood. In there, you have some, rice pudding that I remember my mother making. This flan, which is a custard, that's her recipe, and I remember it from memory, not necessarily from, I had to figure out the measurement of it. And the cream cooler is very prevalent in the Dominican Republic to make because obviously as an island, a tropical island is very hot. So this is what they make to cool off. Right. And I had some colleagues of mine that in the hospitality department that I asked them for recipes and they were, they obviously gave me some recipes for the book itself, because we have culinarians and pastry instructors, and they also worked with vanilla. So they were very happy to provide those recipes for the book. And I also experimented with cocktails, and some of the cocktails that you see in the book is part of that experimentation, as well as some beauty products that at home that you can make with the actual vanilla bean. So vanilla revered, and now is part of us. It's part of a language. It's in everyday home products that the average person is not able to connect of how this flavoring came about. It is the second most expensive flavoring that there exists, and we really have a lot of appreciation for it. I do, but. Needless to say, with all the research that I have done and how this book came about, I discovered that Dominican vanilla is actually artificial vanilla. It is synthetic, to my disappointment. So what was an inspiration as a child, from my childhood, became obviously a book and something, a discovery that it was surprising to me.
Most extensive and fascinating history, Rosa. You actually already answered many of the questions I was going to ask, so you made my job much easier. Thank you for that. And to wrap up the interview, I'd like to ask whether you are working on something right now, or are you thinking about, you know, doing a research on a particular topic, perhaps on another, global history of another food item in the near future?
Well, I actually have been toying with the idea of another topic. At the moment, I've been involved with a research group for Latin American restaurants and healthy eating. So this research has been now been a year, where we actually have interviewed Latin American restaurants here in New York City, and we're trying to improve the health of the Latino community. So we've been quite involved in that. And at the moment, I'm co-writing articles with those other researchers. I have thought of also topics of doing a presentation at the Oxford Food Symposium coming up in 2022. So some ideas are running through my head while I'm co-writing two articles with this particular research group.
I see. Thank you, Rosa. And any further comments, anything you want to add, any kind of readings you want to, you know, recommend or anything?
Well, obviously, the way the topic of how did I ended up with reaction books was, I was researching, I was doing a conference presentation on paella, and paella in comparing it to culture. And I came upon the book Rice. And Rice gave me all of the historical history that I needed for this conference presentation. And that's how I came upon this particular edible series. And I recommend the series itself because I believe it gives you it gives you the history, it gives you, you know, where we are, and it also gives you a lot of interesting recipes.
I totally agree with you. It's one of my favorite series too, Rosa. Thank you so much, Rosa, for being here and for talking to me about your amazing book. I enjoyed reading it very much, and I enjoyed it even more to discuss it with you. So thank you again.
Thank you.
Thank you.